sir. Edison is trying to help a girl find her mom. That's it.
Not anymore, he isn't. Sensor says pull it, we pull it. Pull it, Murray. Story's over.
Pull it.
Have you any idea how successful censorship is on TV? Don't know the answer? Successful, isn't it?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Will Israel's security minister, Israel Katz, ever bring security to his country by threatening nuclear war with Iran? So Israel's intelligence, security and transport minister Israel Katz says he's building a high-speed rail link to Oman too. We hear his views on relations with Iran in our occasional series, Getting to Know the Israeli Cabinet. And drone wars. UK funding goes ahead for autonomous killer drones. And what about hacking airliners full of passengers, effectively turning them into drones? And cars are even easier. Plus, the CIA has even admitted it's looking into doing just that, to assassinate people. Hacking them and driving them into a wall. Or into the ground, or into the sea if it's an aircraft. And if you haven't seen Vaxxed about how the pharmaceutical industry is taking over drug regulation in Europe and the US and also around the world, they are deciding policy. You should see the film. Why have drug companies cancelled clinical tests on combining different vaccinations into one, like the MMR? And why do our national press still talk about Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who says he's proven links between MMR and autism? They say he's discredited, while so much of the attack on his research has been thrown out in the courts. Also, the author of The Secret College, William Stewart, again, on the origins of Zionism and the setting up of a Western fortress state to take over the Middle East. Rounding off our look at seven supposed wars and revolutions right up to the creation of fake Muslim religion in Wahhabism, funded by the Saudis around the world from the US oil revenues. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, a special this week with Steve Wide, who was born in the house at the end of Birnbeck Pier. Let's talk all about corruption in Weston-super-Mare and the history of the use of steamers from there. You can listen to Dialect, BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday here, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, what is going on with threatening nuclear war with Iran? Why is Israel doing this? They're saying, and we're going to hear from Israel Katz in a minute, that their intelligence and transport and security minister, cabinet minister, all about why he is not interested in talking to the Iranians at all.
Well, it's pretty clear that the Israelis have been pushing for an all-out war with Iran for quite a long time, and Donald Trump seems to be on the same page with them, as is Mohammed bin Salman, that great who has also, of course, been exonerated by his own police this week for not being involved with the Khashoggi murder. So that's glad that one's been sorted out. It's very dangerous. And Britain, of course, is in alliance with Israel, the United States, and therefore we're dragged into this as well,
so
whether we like it or not.
What have the Iranians done so wrong?
What the Iranians have done so wrong is have an independent country and an independent policy, which can't be controlled by Washington, and also, of course, that they are hostile to the continued land grabs by the Israeli state. And they are basically the opposition to all of that. And, you know, that's why they've got to be, you know, basically taken out as far as the gangsters are concerned.
The Guardian's saying today, Martin, that Trump's economic war on Iran is doomed to failure. Actually, the Guardian, for a change, seems to be actually agreeing with Rouhani.
Well, what's happened as a result of what Trump's done is that Rouhani and Khatami, who are the sort of leaders of the conservative and liberal factions, if you can call them that, are on the same page. The Iranian people are very well aware that if the sanctions are placed on Iran, that that's what's causing their misery, and they're going to unite behind the government against being bullied around.
The Americans are hoping that by threatening to sanction anybody that trades with Iran, that they will be able to stop. But the Europeans are standing up to this. Richard Dalton in the Guardian today is saying, with demand for Iranian oil holding firm and no international support for the sanctions, the US's harsh approach has no future.
Well, in the long run, I would say that's definitely correct. But in the short run, lots of European companies have pulled out of Iran, despite what their governments think, because they're not prepared to face sanctions from the US, because the US is one of their biggest customers. So in that sense, it's been quite effective. But it's also been quite effective in roiling the stock markets around the world and creating the possibility of a crash. And of course, the Iranians can always, if it comes to a real fight, I think they will win, actually, because the geography is on their side. In every possible way you can imagine.
He's also saying the US has declared economic war on Iran after having pulled out of the UN Security Council endorsed nuclear deal in May. The Trump administration is now unilaterally combating the right of the rest of the world to engage in legal trade with the Islamic Republic. Now this looks to be a bit like a kind of showdown, nose to nose, with Rouhani and Trump. Who's going to win?
Well, as I said earlier, if it comes to an all-out fight, the Iranians will definitely win, which is why the Americans and the Israelis will try and avoid it.
So why have they done that in the first place?
Well, they're under the delusion that by making the Iranian people suffer, they will rise up and overthrow the government that they themselves elected. And I don't think there's any shred of evidence that's a likely outcome. The real problem for the Americans is if they keep using the dollar as a blunt instrument to beat other people over the head with, they're going to develop other ways of doing business, and that is going to be decisive for bringing American power down.
Okay, so who is Richard Dalton? Well, I'll tell you, he is the UK ambassador to Tehran in 2005. Mm-hmm. He received the country's rejection of the first attempt by the West to strike a nuclear deal. Alongside his French and German colleagues, analysts often go wrong because we think that fights will come, that the fights to come will be like the fights of our day, but this is what I believe will happen. He says, in my view, Iran will remain basically stable despite the surge of inflation and tough recession that IMF says is coming down the line. Discontent and maybe protests will significantly increase. Iran's leaders will nevertheless weather the storm.
That's about pretty accurate, actually. The idea that by pushing the making the Iranian people poorer and more miserable, they're likely to overthrow, as I say, the government they themselves elected, is unlikely. It's like Britain in World War II. Are we going to give in if they bully us around?
But
no, we're not. We're going
to
dig our heels in.
He's the British ambassador to Iran, so 10 years ago or so. He finishes his article by saying, with its current policies, rather than reaping strategic rewards, the US is putting on a show of weakness to the world, with no prospect of bringing allies to its side or forcing Iran to accept its excessive demands. It's on a hiding to nothing.
That's about right. But they ain't going to stop, because the Israelis are driving the policy and they want a war with Iran because they're bonkers. But do we want a war with Iran? We've got to ask that question, because we're going to be forced into one if we don't.
Okay, so ultimately, I go back to this. Why are they doing this? Why are they pursuing this policy? It doesn't seem to make any sense. Is it basically an Israeli or an American policy?
It's both. The Americans want full-spectrum dominance, they want to dominate the planet, and the Israelis want to dominate the Middle East as the junior partner or the senior partner in the Middle East. And basically, of course, everything could be negotiated with China, with Russia, with Iran, with everybody. But if the imperialist powers, and they are imperialist powers, do not want a multipolar world where they've got to treat people with respect, they want to tell the world what to do. The Iranians kicked out a pro-Western regime in 1979 after the British and the Americans overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1954. The Iranians have got long memories. We used to bully them around and tell them what to do. They kicked us out. and they're quite happy with us being kicked out. And if we have to, if we go to war with them, they will be defending their home turf against us, and they've got plenty of ways to make it hurt for us. Because, for example, they could smash the Saudi oil industry virtually immediately, and that would whack up the oil price and smash the Western economy.
How can they do that?
Well, they've got rocket. I mean, if you think about it, the oil industry is like an incredibly vulnerable target. You've got all of this kind of tanks full of oil, and all you've got to do is hit it with a missile, and it blows up. And easy peasy.
Who controls the Straits of Hormuz?
In actual fact, the navigable part of the Straits of Hormuz is entirely under the, inside in Iranian Iranian territorial waters. So they would be completely within their rights within international law to close it down at any time. But they wouldn't just do that. What the other thing they would
so
do
by closing, Martin, close it, Martin, all the oil that it, we are putting into our cars, petrol, diesel, whatever, is coming through this, a part of Iranian territory.
No, most of the stuff coming through there doesn't come our way, as far as I understand. But the point is, if any loss of supply on the oil market affects the price elsewhere, and of course they wouldn't just close the Straits of Hormuz. If it came to a fight, they would close the Straits of Hormuz, which means that any British ships or American ships inside the Persian Gulf, they will be sunk by land-based missiles, and they will also knock out all of the the Iranians have already said if there are attempts to prevent us exporting oil, we will stop the Saudis exporting oil, which we can easily do. And of course the Iranian army is actually a serious army. It's a very big army, they're very well trained, and of course they fought an 8-year war against Iraq. If it comes to a straight out war between the Saudis and the Iranians, they will win. And I don't think that the Americans have got their backsides kicked in Iraq, and that's a smaller country with much less military resources than Iran. If they think they're going to beat Iran, they're absolutely deluded.
Let's have a listen now then to Israeli Transport, Intelligence and Security Minister Israel Katz speaking in May this year, but it gives you a good idea of where he's coming from.
As son of a Holocaust survivor, as a former paratrooper and officer in the IDF, and as Minister of Intelligence and Transportation, I take great pride in our achievement in both the security and civilian fields. We have realized the Zionist vision of Moses and Herzl and returned to the land that my parents longed for and that a generation of Jews prayed for and never forgot. We built a strong and modern state, which is recognized today as a global center of innovation and excellence. And 51 years ago, we also liberated and united Jerusalem, the eternal capital of the Jewish people, which was recognized by the United States as the capital of Israel. And thanks to President Trump's brave and just decision, the American embassy will move there in the coming days. And we hope to see President Donald Trump celebrating with us in Jerusalem. In order to make the celebration even happier, I would like to ask our great friend President Trump to give the Israeli public one more present and to allow Jonathan Pollard to come to Israel and celebrate with us in Jerusalem. But we also continue to face threats, and today Iran presents the biggest threat to Israel and the region. The developments on the North Korean issue in recent days may show that President Trump's tough policy doctrine, which combines sanctions and the willingness to use force, is paying off, and we hope that it will succeed. It seems that when it comes to determine dictatorships, the tough approach is much more effective than engagement and compromise.
Well, I mean, that's pretty standard Israeli right-wing boilerplate. He mentioned Jonathan Pollard there earlier. Jonathan Pollard was a US Navy person, and what he did for money is he sold the US's nuclear secrets to the Israelis for money, and then the Israelis gave those nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union in return for allowing Jews to leave the Soviet Union and come to Israel. And he was captured by the FBI, convicted as a spy, and sent to prison because he'd basically sold out the US national security for money paid for by the Israelis. But in Israel, he's regarded as a hero, because, of course, what he did is he helped the Israelis develop nuclear weapons completely illegally, with which they threatened Iran and various other countries around the world, including the former defence intellectual.
But, I mean, surely he'll come out of prison eventually, or get parole or whatever. Then
in the US itself, it's quite a serious question, because under existing US law, he should probably have been executed, never mind just sent to prison. But of course, the Israelis is a hero. And of course, I would put that to any middle American Trump voter. So a guy who sells America's nuclear secrets to its enemies, then they end up in the hands of the Soviet Union for money, to the Israelis, he's a hero. Now, is he an American hero? I don't think he is he?
What about this policy we just heard there? No negotiation, no compromise. Why?
Well, because of the negotiation and compromise, then they wouldn't get what they want, which is a greater Israel in a Middle East which is in turmoil because of the Israeli policy of supporting terrorists, for example, in Syria and elsewhere. Basically, we're shaping up for a major Middle East war. And of course, he said Jerusalem was the capital of Israel. When Israel was recognised by both the Soviet Union and the United States in 1948. There was recognised within an agreed border. Yeah? And when Slobodan Milosevic said, no, Kosovo belongs to Serbia, we went to war with Serbia and bombed their TV station. 73-day bombing campaign killed 10,000 civilians. Meanwhile, the Israelis continue land grabbing, and not only do they not get punished, they get rewarded. And of course, everybody around the world can see the message of that. Might is right. Okay? If might is right, might is right. Let's see the Russian army take on the Israelis. And maybe there won't be in a state of Israel at the end of World War III.
Let's have a listen now to Russia's 100 years. We heard a little bit of it last week. 100 years of the GRU. In this clip, we're hearing again from the wonderful Mark Galliati from the Institute for International Affairs in Prague, all about how actually Russia has been stealing a march on the West using their GRU intelligence service.
Russia is extremely active in this often aggressive form of espionage, and the West is vulnerable, is a bit soft, doesn't really know how to do this stuff.
It's from the World Service.
Well, look, there's some truth in that, I think, but it's not, I think, so much that the West is particularly soft, though obviously we could be tougher in terms of our response. It's as much as anything else about spending. Look, about 40% of the entire Russian federal budget goes on security, broadly conceptualised. And now a lot of that is on tanks and guns and soldiers and police. But a lot of that also goes into Putin's spies. In the West, we have tended to underspend on counterintelligence. And at a time when it's interesting, we have a kind of commonly agreed figure within NATO of 2% of GDP that should be spent on military defence. We have no common sense of counterintelligence, which means that some countries, and actually Britain does quite well in this, spend a reasonable amount on counterintelligence. Other countries spend dramatically less. So I think one of the problems is that we have neglected this historically. And therefore, it's very difficult to suddenly ramp up your counterintelligence activities.
Well, I just don't think that's true, frankly. The Western intelligence service are massively bloated. Homeland Security in the United States of America, which never existed in 2001, employs a million people. A million people on salaries. There's nothing like that in Russia. And the Russians, of course, have got their intelligence services. We've got ours. The idea that they are, what they want is they just want to negotiate with us in a reasonable fashion. But we're determined to overthrow their government, their elected government, and they're not very happy about that.
One of the things he didn't say there was that the Russian military budget is roughly 15% of just the US, never alone NATO's budget.
Well, indeed, but also because it's a nationalised setup over there, the kit they get is actually usable, and their army is actually now a volunteer army, and it's pretty good.
And
they've done a pretty good job in Syria, far better than we did in Iraq.
We hear this just in May this year that Russian military spending has dropped this year for the first time in 20 years. The West is saying it's because the Russian economy is not doing very well. The Russians are saying it's because we don't need to spend any more. Our military is doing okay.
That's right, because basically they haven't got the same objectives as the West. The Russian military is there to defend Russia and certain key allies who are in near proximity to Russia. That's all they want to do. And they don't need to spend any more than that, and they've got plenty of other things to spend their money on. And they're quite rational about all of this. The problem is the West. We've got a military-industrial complex that doesn't know the meaning of when to stop. It's, if they just want to do spend more money on weaponry, because the people who run the political parties, they make money themselves from weapons expenditure. You know, most politicians in the US are on the board of companies which produce weaponry. So it's a self-reinforcing cycle. The Russians have decided that we're not going to go down that road, because mostly a lot of Western expenditure on the military is wasted. It's just basically bribery and corruption, and you don't even get a usable bit of kit at the end of it. And so therefore, you know, the presentation by that chap about, you know, I just don't recognise that as reality. He's probably on a scholarship, or his academic career is basically funded by NATO. So he comes out with what NATO wants him to say. Yeah. And I would say that if we looked into where his funding came from, you'd find it pretty much directly comes from NATO. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
So 40% of the budget apparently in Russia goes towards various types of military. But if you look online, look at the various statistics, it's much, much, much lower than that, actually. So it's like 20%, so half of what he's actually telling us.
Yeah, so in other words, and don't forget that half of all US expenditure goes on the military. Half of every tax dollar goes on military expenditure in the US, and it's a much bigger economy than Russia. So in other words, he's basically just come up with a statistic off the back of an envelope.
Interesting,
there.
Isn't it, in the week where the BBC...
And he's supposed to be an
academic.
The
BBC World Service and the BBC generally have embarked this week on some bizarre exercise called Beyond Fake News. Mm. Now, I'm not quite sure what Beyond Fake News is supposed to be. Maybe we'll hear a little bit about that. And I just found it bizarre that they've got Marie Helly and Dan Damon on the World Update on the BBC World Service talking about this. So you've got Damon and Mary Helly chatting about going beyond fake news. Let's just see if we can make a little bit of sense out of what they're describing here.
Beyond Fake News is a season across the World Service in English and other languages, and Marie Helly is one of the people behind the series. Tell us about it, Marie.
Well, we were rather worried that the whole term fake news was being used in a rather toxic way, that in America it was being used as a term of abuse to people you just simply didn't agree with. And we realised that around the globe, and in particular India and Africa, there were huge problems associated with the spread of fake news on social media and the amplification that digital media creates. In India, we know that rumours are being spread on encrypted networks like WhatsApp, and this has led to people being murdered because they're thought to be kidnappers of children. We know in Kenya that there were fake front page headlines, fake news attributed to mainstream organisations like the BBC. So we felt we had to do more than just report these stories, that we needed to be much more proactive as a broadcaster. So at the moment, today, there's two major conferences going on in Delhi and in Nairobi, with bringing together key players who run the platforms, talking about these things, trying to find solutions. We commissioned some audience research looking at why people share fake news, and we discovered that it's a very emotional thing. People like to share things that they already agree with, and in India that's particularly looks to, you know, to be a key way of people sharing stories around Hindu nationalism, about creating a narrative of the story of nationhood. In Africa, more about sharing, you know, very damaging things like false news about health, etc. So we're out there in schools, we're inviting children to take part in the sort of projects we already have in the UK to help people understand how to be critical about what they're seeing and viewing. The main thing we think is this is a danger to truth itself and to mainstream broadcasters. So whether it's in Russia or other parts of the world, the sharing of fake news undermines the whole notion of truth itself and who people can rely on. That's why we're doing it.
Well, truth itself, that's a big topic, isn't it? If you actually look at the American Revolution or the English Civil War or the French Revolution, there was a plethora of pamphlets And the historians look at them, and they're scurrilous pamphlets. It's freedom of speech. The problem with freedom of speech is people are going to say stuff you don't like. Now, if people want to, the BBC is a relatively, you know, responsible broadcaster, but they're involved in political disinformation of various kinds.
Well, we've just heard, for example, that they're saying that the Russian military spending is 40% of the budget. They've got their so-called expert on there, you say maybe employed by NATO. To say it's 40%, and we've just shown, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, that actually Russian military spending is roughly 20% of their annual budget, and it's falling. So
yeah, well, there you go.
They're peddling fake news.
It's pot kettle black. Now, I do accept that the BBC have got a higher standard of news presentation than something like Fox News, for example. But if you're going to be serious about dealing with all of this, let's have some straightforward rules. The tabloid press in Britain frequently makes up stories about immigrants, about scroungers, about all sorts of things. Should they be banned from saying that stuff? I don't think they should. Well, I don't agree with it, but I don't think they should be banned from saying it, because it's a slippery slope.
I think
Once you start banning people saying things, then what are you going to do?
I think would be interesting to get. I mean, she kind of gave it away there, really. What she was saying there was that it couldn't be controlled.
Well, indeed.
Social media is something where people can share things that they believe, not that the broadcasters, people like her, believe.
Well, and there's always going to be a problem with freedom of speech, is that people will say things that you don't agree with, or even lie. I mean, dare I say it, politicians lie. Trump lies all the time. Theresa May probably lies. And the fact is, you can't stop them lying. The check on that is you don't vote for them if you think they've been deceiving
you.
Wasn't
there something inevitable about fake news as a term turning back, blowing back in the face of the mainstream press when they first came out with it?
Well, of course, if you actually think about it, the tabloid press in Britain is openly partisan. There is no attempt at balance at all. Now, you could argue that anybody who's involved in any kind of presentation of media should be balanced, as we try to be on this show. But on the other hand, you could argue that there's no rule that says that people should be balanced. The idea is that everybody speaks and everybody gets a chance to say what they think, and then people get to make their minds up based on what they've heard. And you can't just say, well, we're not going to let you hear the other side's point of view. For example, Russia Today attempts to ban Russia Today, where I was on this week. Why do you want to stop people having their say? If you don't agree with it, well, you have your say, and then we'll see. It'll all come out through discussion. Well, that's the theory of freedom of speech and democracy.
Martin, my pet channel, Press TV, is banned here in the UK.
Well, indeed. And why is Fox News allowed to operate but Press TV not? And the obvious answer is quite straightforward. That's our propaganda, so-called, and that's their propaganda, and that's why their propaganda is banned. But you know what? The modern internet allows people to find out anything they want with pretty very little restriction.
But it's very challenging. Martin, people don't have the time. Martin, people don't have the time to look into everything themselves, do they?
No, they don't. And that's why, you know, people like you and myself do lots of research every week so that we can summarise it for our listeners, because they don't have the time to give that we've got to give to it. People are going to make, you know, you either believe in freedom of speech or you don't. Now, of course, the BBC have lied, for example, about various things to do with the Syrian conflict, the white helmets and all the rest of it, being presented to us as some kind of humanitarian organisation, when they are, in fact, funded by the British government and allied with Al-Qaeda.
More importantly,
but the BBC didn't want to tell us
chemical attacks by the Assad government, apparently.
Yes, which never took place. But the BBC immediately just fell in line with the government's line. There you go.
So
should they be banned for doing that? I don't think so.
I'd love to have been a fly on the wall at the committee at the BBC that decided to come up with the title Beyond Fake News.
Well, everybody's just swimming around in this swamp trying to accuse everybody else of telling fibs when they're not looking at the beam in their own eye before the moat in their opposition. The fact is, in the modern era, with English language internet, is they cannot control the narratives in the way that they used to do. And that upsets them. Because in the past, they could tell lies about something like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and those lies would hold solid for a good decade or so before they were exposed. Nowadays, they're virtually exposed straight away, and there's nothing they can do about it.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we move on now to talk about the drone wars, that is, off the leash, how the UK is developing the technology to build armed autonomous drones. A new report published by Drone Wars UK reveals that, despite a UK government statement that it does not possess fully autonomous weapons and has no intention of developing them, the Ministry of Defence is actively funding research into technology supporting development of armed autonomous drones. Their study, Off the Leash, the Development of Autonomous Military Drones in the UK, identifies the key technologies influencing the development of future armed drones and looks at current initiatives which are underway in the UK to marry developments in autonomy, the ability, that is, of a machine to operate with limited or even no human control, with military drone technology. The report maps out the agencies, laboratories and contractors undertaking research into drones and autonomous weapon technology in support of the Ministry of Defence. It examines the risks arising from the weaponisation of technologies like this and assesses the government policy in this area. So effectively the MOD is saying we're not doing it, and dronewars.net and their report Off the Leash is saying, yes, you are.
Well, the stuff I read this week was saying that they admitted that they were doing it, but so I'm a bit confused. I think the most significant, I mean, obviously drone wars have been going on for quite a long time, but I think the significance is of this new phase of technology is that the drones will themselves decide when they're going to open fire without a human being deciding whether they're going to do it. So, you know, that is a bit worrying, because then you've actually got an autonomous robot killer, which can then just set off and kill people without being, how would you stop it?
We've had the
or
Terminator,
switch it off if you don't like what it's doing.
The Terminator gene. Well, this is the Terminator of the film, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the danger of all this technology is that by some error we end up in a major war which could go nuclear, because some drone decides to whack somebody and all the rest of it without anybody having any human being entering into the process of deciding the making the decision.
You've hit the nail on the head here, because this is what this technology is for. It's because human beings don't like killing people for no reason.
Well, they do. Some do, some don't. But I mean, the technology of modern warfare is pretty horrifying.
Well, what I'm saying is,
they're
trying to cut the human decision out of the process. Press a button and say, right. Well, I mean, effectively, it's like a kind of a video game. So you press a button and it goes killing people.
It's quite clear that this generation of high-tech pilots is going to be the last one, because, you know, aircraft in the future will not have a pilot.
Look, Martin, what I'm trying to get at here is the idea of this is effectively a kind of trying to integrate game theory into modern warfare.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. I mean, what it is the development of weapon arms races do this. Weapons become more and more sophisticated, and more money spent on them.
Supercomputers, and you can beat the chess masters at chess on using those supercomputers. But if you can translate that into the battlefield, you could win a war.
Well, I mean, this kind of technology is used by major powers, Western powers usually, to try and control the Third World. And obviously, from a military point of view, the answer to that is to find out where they're building the drones and go around there and whack them. And you don't necessarily need to have a drone to do that.
Those drones are mostly being built in the UK, the US and Israel.
Well, indeed. And therefore, they're being used by those powers to dominate less technologically sophisticated countries and civilizations. And the answer to that is to, if from a military point of view, and I'm not recommending this from a political point of view, is you say, right, well, these are the people responsible, we're going to find them and we're going to eliminate them.
The other big announcement this week, and many would be raising eyebrows about Germany announcing this, is Angela Merkel calling, as Macron did last week, for the creation of a real, true EU army. The German Chancellor's call echoes Emmanuel Macron's similar call last week, the John Stone says in The Independent. Angela Merkel's call for the creation of a real, true European army. German Chancellor's backing for the force comes amid a spat with the US President Donald Trump, who took offence to a suggestion by Macron last week that such an army could ensure Europe's security in the shadow of the United States. Ms. Merkel endorsed the creation of the army while addressing members of the European Parliament in Strasbourg this week. "We should work on a vision of one day establishing a real, true European army," Mrs. Merkel said. The French president made his call during a radio interview last week. So they're both on the same page on this one, Martin. Are you?
Well, I think it's most unlikely that they're going to be able to develop a European army, because trying to get anybody to agree to anything in the EU is a huge uphill struggle. And there's countries like Ireland who would be completely opposed to it, whatever they may say.
Would it be a counterbalance to NATO? What would be the difference?
Well, I think that, don't forget that, that General de Gaulle took France out of the structure of NATO in the 1960s and kicked all US bases out of France. There are no US soldiers based in France. They don't allow it. And ultimately, of course, if America is going to become a rogue state, invading Iran, for example, we might need to defend ourselves against them. But it's not, we won't really need an army. We're going to need a political movement to kick them out.
Do you think Angela Merkel's EU army will be equipped with drones?
Well, I've no idea, because I think it's basically pie in the sky. It's a sort of thing that is talked about at a sort of bureaucratic level in France and Germany, and of course they can talk about it more openly
but
now.
Just done a whole load of joint exercises. They've now actually in the last few years they're allowing various armed forces of different nations to go into those other nations and do manoeuvres internally.
Well, yeah, but
alongside, say for example, French troops. I was going up the M5 a couple of years ago, and there's a whole load of French troops in convoy going up to do an exercise up north with the British.
Yeah. Well, the
integration is happening, isn't it?
Well, the integration. Don't forget that NATO has just had its biggest exercises since World War II in Norway, directed directly at the Russians. So that's not the EU, that's NATO. Okay? And people going on about sovereignty. We're talking about in the first hour sovereignty and the EU. Do you know who's taken our sovereignty in this country? The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is run by the United States of America, and dragged us into a war in Iraq, which we didn't really want to have, and we foolishly went
Tony
along
Blair
with it.
Did.
Well, he did, didn't he? But we shouldn't have gone along with it.
We didn't want to have it. No, our Prime Minister, your Labour Prime Minister,
yes,
did.
Indeed. But the point is that what may happen as a result of the changing geopolitical situation in the world is that NATO should be disbanded. I'm all in favour of disbanding NATO, and ultimately, of course, if NATO becomes a war-making, and as it is, a war-making organisation, it will be disbanded or defeated.
Not if it becomes, it is. Anyway, in Ukraine this week, the European Union is condemning elections in the separatist-held parts of Ukraine this week, which were held last weekend.
Yep. And of course, Alexander Zakarchenko.
Why are they condemning some other country's elections? What because, right have they got to do that?
Because under the Minsk Agreement, in theory, there was an agreement that the Ukrainians would withdraw their heavy weaponry from the contact line, and the other side would do the same, and then elections which both sides could respect would be held. Now, the Ukrainians have not withdrawn their heavy weapon from the contact line, and far from it, they've been actually shelling into Donetsk.
Why haven't they then?
Because they don't want to accept that these countries...
The heavy weapons are still in the Donetsk.
Yeah.
And they can only really take those back if the same happens on the Ukrainians.
The Ukrainians are determined to recapture these two breakaway republics. Just as, you know, mainstream opinion in Serbia is still of the opinion that Kosovo is part of Serbia. And they're never going to accept it as an independent state. And of course, they've been waiting to hold elections so that they, you know, it could be on an agreed basis. But since there isn't an agreed basis, they've got to go forward and hold elections. Otherwise, the people running these two breakaway republics haven't got any mandate to do anything.
Another really interesting story this week, but hardly reported anywhere. This is on the Register. Okay, Google, why was your web traffic hijacked and routed through China and Russia today? This is BGP hijacking committed grand theft internet. And this was on... that's at the weekend, that story. Absolutely incredible. Apparently, for 2.5 hours, all Google's traffic was routed through China and Russia. This is the internet, and if anyone was trying to use the Google cloud services, they would have found it was unavailable and that their requests on the internet were going through to Russia and China, Martin.
Well, that's the first I've heard of this.
Well, that's right. It's not been reported at all, has it?
Well, I mean, the thing... don't forget that Russia and China are being set up as the big bad guys on the planet. And it may very well be that this is not what it seems. They keep talking about there's going to be a Russian cyber attack on the banks, which is going to bring the banks down. And when the banks crash, it's not the banks crashing, it's the Russians doing it through cyber attacks. We're being primed for that sort of nonsense. And that
so
is fake
let me
news.
Just explain. The black hole effect meant that Google and YouTube and apps and sites that relied on Google Cloud appeared to be offline. It's possible information not securely encrypted could have been intercepted by the aforementioned rogue nodes. However, our understanding at the register, they say, is that due to the black hole effect, it's likely few, if any, connections were spied on. But the fact is, Martin, that the internet isn't necessarily as secure as we think it is.
Well, it isn't secure at all. Anybody who thinks that the internet is secure is absolutely deluded. And if you're serious about doing anything that you don't want anybody to know about, you don't do it online, do you?
Or anything that, I mean, we think about things like internet banking.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's a constant arms race to connect to. I mean, at one stage, people wouldn't use the internet to make payments because they were scared that they would lose their details and there would be robbery. They've managed to sort of, you know, most people are now pretty happy to use the internet to pay for things. But of course, that may change. You know, all it takes is some talented young person to work out how to go around whatever they've concocted, and it's all vulnerable. And you know, that's the reality, and that includes drones, of course. These drones may be hackable, and so these killer drones could be given other instructions, like go back to base and eliminate it. Yeah, and that is modern cyber warfare.
Love Bristol, love BCFM 93.2.
Looking at this whole business of drones and hacking, we had mentioned this a few weeks ago, the Lion Air aircraft from Jakarta that flew straight into the sea. Incredible, really, that you've got two people in Forbes magazine and Newsweek both saying that these aircraft can be hacked, and yet nobody has been mentioning that whatsoever. So when we go back to MH370, this is the aircraft that was heading from Malaysia to Beijing, Martin, that starts to look as if that may have been a potential hacking too. So the CIA have admitted in their Vault 7 leaks from Julian Assange and WikiLeaks that they are using hacking of cars, that's what they said in that report, but presumably other things too. I mean, for example, you can control the engine of a locomotive potentially remotely, in a train. You can control ships potentially remotely, and aircraft too. So what about, let's go back to this MH370 once more, because this is a supposed to be a disappearance. Isn't it quite probable that the aircraft that disappeared 3 years ago and supposedly was never found was simply hacked?
Well, Global Hawk technology has existed since the early 1970s. An aircraft, a Boeing 747 or whatever it was flown all the way from America to New Zealand in 1971. And of course, it looks like all the planes on 9/11, because of their flight paths, were not being piloted by the pilots, because you can't actually fly on site above the crowd level, and they were dodging around all over the place, which implies that somebody was flying them from the ground, and of course that is the reality, because of the electronic nature of aeroplanes and cars these days. Michael Hastings, who was a journalist looking into the CIA's role in various things, his car, which was a brand new car with all the electronics in, suddenly accelerated into a wall at 90 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone, as I understand, and he died in the flames as it exploded. There's very big suspicions that that was an assassination by the CIA, because he was actually just about to write loads of stuff about them, which they didn't want to come out.
Actually, it was 4 years ago, not three. But the Malaysian plane, a fascinating article, saying that came out really pretty much at the time, that 20 passengers worked for the electronic warfare and military radar firm that were on that aircraft that disappeared, a US technology company, which had 20 senior staff on board Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, had just launched a new electronic warfare gadget for military radar systems in the days before the Boeing 777 went missing, says the Daily Express. Freescale Semiconductor, which makes powerful microchips for industries including defence, released the powerful new products to the American market on the 3rd of March. 5 days later, MH370 took off for Kuala Lumpur for Beijing with 239 people on board, including 20 working for Freescale. Now, presumably they were taking this technology to the Chinese, and some Americans might not have been happy about that.
Well, you've got to always ask yourself a question when something like that happens. What were the motives for people to hack it and bring it down? But you've just pointed out what that motive might be.
One of the major shareholders in Freescale is the Carlyle Group, private equity investors whose past advisors included ex-President George Bush Sr. and former British Prime Minister John Major. This is where they're putting their money. They think they can make a lot of money like this.
Well, exactly, but don't forget the political class in the US and Britain is absolutely in the pocket of the military-industrial complex. When they retire from the boring, rather underpaid job of being Prime Minister or President, there's loads of money to be made just by being a name on the letterhead of the organisations producing this kit.
But back in second, let's go back even further, that was 4 years ago. What about 1994? What's that? 24 years ago. Mull of Kintyre ZD-576 Chinook crash. That particular aircraft, I mean, there's a great article in ComputerWorldUK.com, and they're saying that there's a lot of unanswered software questions about that Chinook crash. Now, the timing of it was just after the IRA ceasefire in 1994, and this was full of army intelligence, this helicopter.
Well, the question you have to ask is, why were all the top people on one helicopter? Because it's not, and therefore...
Well, they weren't expecting it to crash, were they?
Well, no, but you always expect it to crash. Why were all the top Polish politicians on that plane that crashed on the way to Kursk?
What I'm saying is, Martin, asking you for a little bit of help here with, is what might be the political significance around 1994 of getting rid of, potentially deliberately, 25 British Army intelligence personnel?
Well, at the time, the IRA made a statement, P. O'Neill made a statement in Dublin saying, you may think that we've done this, but though we're happy enough to see all these people dead, because of course it was, you know, the situation was still not resolved, it was nothing to do with us. The question for those involved is, why have you got everybody on the same helicopter? You shouldn't do that. It's because accidents happen, never mind anything else.
Anyway, 2 months after the crash was the IRA ceasefire, and another 2 months after that, the Loyalist ceasefire.
Well, one possibility is that these people were hardliners who weren't interested in a ceasefire, so they had to be eliminated. That same thing happened on the IRA side. The Lockall ambush, basically, the IRA set up Jim Lennar because he was opposed to compromise. You know, it's a very dirty, murky world out there, especially when you're talking about stuff like this.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip from the Vaxxed documentary. Reason I'm really, there's only one reason I'm more interested in this is because I had a vaccination December last year, and around about beginning of February, I started to get a pain in my left arm. Goodness sake. I have no idea whether it is or not, but certainly it seems to have not gone away since. Was that the vaccination? I would say almost certainly it was, because the pain has just stayed there just where I was vaccinated. So I thought I'd have a re-look at this again. And here's a little clip of the trailer from the Vaxxed film, which came out a couple of years ago. V-A-X-X-E-D.
There's a whistleblower from the CDC come out and say that the CDC had committed fraud on the MMR study and that they knew that vaccines were actually causing autism.
My oldest son, Ian, was walking and running. After the vaccine, he was no longer able to do that.
So I called a clinic and I said, I think my child's had adverse reaction to those shots.
And then came the head bang, the constant banging against anything that he could find.
The first thing that Thompson did was to plot a graph. Now, if there's no link between early MMR and autism, those two lines should track together. Now, they do track together until they get to 15 months. Then they separate, and they continue to separate thereafter. And they sliced and diced the data in an effort to get rid of that effect.
The relative risk of receiving an autism diagnosis was astronomical.
Wow. The CDC had known all along there was this MMR autism risk.
In CDC's judgment, the best public policy is to continue vaccination unchanged.
Omission of crucial data, destruction of documents, misleading the Congress, grievous harm to innocent children.
Everything I've been telling my patients for the last 10 years has been based on a lie and a cover-up.
In 1978, the prevalence of autism was about 1 in 15,000 children.
If we assume that things are going to continue as they have, we can predict that by 2032, 80% of the boys born will end up on the autism spectrum. Half the children, 80% of the boys.
It's a vast number of children who are being diagnosed with autism every day.
This is going to be a complete catastrophe if we just let it happen.
There's a problem in all of this, Martin, and that is that the pharmaceutical industry makes lots and lots of money when people are ill.
Well, indeed. I mean, I'm agnostic about this. I don't know enough about it to have a very strong opinion. But I have a very strong opinion about the pharmaceutical companies. They should be nationalised and run for public in the public interest.
But one of the things we keep hearing is this discredited Andrew Wakefield. Well, is he really discredited? Let's ask him.
The licensing board for doctors in the UK is called the General Medical Council, and you are judged by your peers in medicine and some lay people as well. At the GMC, there were three defendants. Professor Walker Smith, who was at the time the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist, a very senior man with an impeccable record, an unimpeachable career. One of his juniors, Dr. Simon Murch, and myself. All three of us were found guilty. Simon Murch did not lose his license, but Walker Smith and I lost our license. He was then funded to appeal in the English High Court. I did appeal, but for financial reasons, it was impossible for me to pursue that, and it was not a primary objective after that, to restore my license. There were more important things to do. But Professor Walker Smith did appeal, and at that appeal, the first time this case had ever come before a proper judiciary, a proper judge, then the judge destroyed the General Medical Council's decision. He said effectively they were incompetent, they were not in a position to judge the evidence, that they made mistakes, they got the facts wrong, they misrepresented the evidence, and worse of all, they were biased. They had made up their minds from the outset that we were guilty. And he completely overturned their decision and said, in effect, this must never happen again. Walker Smith was completely reinstated and all charges against him utterly dismissed. 90% of the charges against Walker Smith were the same charges as those against me. The paper should have been reinstated, and yet the Lancet editor refused to do that in order to protect his reputation and his job. So, did that ever find its way into the newspapers? Briefly. One newspaper.
One newspaper report. It's something that the newspapers, for some reason, didn't want to hear, that the entire medical regulation profession and the pharmaceutical industry had been discredited in this one way. It doesn't sound very balanced to me. But anyway, let's have a listen also to Andrew Wakefield again, talking about how this whole thing started in the first place, with the World Health Organization weighing in the UK, saying that the big pharmaceutical companies here should not do trials into the new MMR vaccine.
Professor Zuckerman is on the World Health Organization as an expert on hepatitis B vaccine. Felt it was necessary to try and prevent vaccine safety research. Why? Because as Zuckerman said when he wrote to the British Medical Association to determine whether the work was ethical, clearly this could lead to a case against the government for damages. And yet the case that I was involved in was not against the government. It was apparently against the vaccine manufacturers. So where did this come from, a case against the government? In fact, Dr. Armstrong, the chairman of the British Medical Association's Ethical Committee, wrote back to him and said not to conduct this research because it might embarrass the medical school or lead to a case in litigation against the government is not a sound moral footing. And he urged that the work should be done. In fact, Professor Zuckerman put that letter deep in the bottom of a drawer and it never emerged until the General Medical Council inquiry. Why? Why could it lead to a case against the government? On Newcastle Station in 1997, I met a whistleblower from the government who was in fact that doctor who'd been brought over from Canada to advise on the introduction of MMR in the UK, the one who said, do not do it, the one who said, you must have active surveillance. His name is Dr. Alistair Torrance, and he told us about the prevailing attitude in the Department of Health at that time, which he said was bordering on the fascist. He was deeply concerned that many children had been badly damaged by this vaccine. They'd been discarded because they were the unacceptable face of a government policy, and that the vaccine had been introduced because it was a quarter the price of MMR2. They wanted to give the market to the home team, SmithKline Beecham, and it was a cheap vaccine. So the government, knowing this vaccine was unsafe, had put price before the safety of children. And he had disclosed all of this to me, not once, but twice. He called himself George at that stage. What had happened is that SmithKline Beecham, when it was proposed that they should have a lion's share of the market in the UK, said, we're not happy with this because we're having problems with this vaccine in Canada and elsewhere. Because the government so wanted this vaccine, presumably because of the price, they offered to indemnify SmithKline Beecham against damage caused. It is not certain that this indemnity was in any way legal or had ministerial approval. Pluserix, as I say, was cheaper. And in the JCVI minutes, this is confirmed as late as 1993, SmithKline Beecham continue to sell the Urabi strain vaccine without liability. This is something that David Salisbury has repeatedly denied. And yet here it is in the minutes for which he was personally responsible.
Pretty incredible, Martin, that the British government are prepared to indemnify GlaxoSmithKline against any damages. I mean, why are we paying for them? I mean, if their vaccine damages someone, surely they should pay.
Well, don't forget that, you know, the whole it's all very regulated, and of course the pharmaceutical industry has got its own vested interests. That's why I said earlier that the logical thing to do is to nationalise that. That wouldn't necessarily solve all the problems.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details this week, oneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre.